4:55, September 21st.
Okay, good morning.
So, today we're going to talk about about reliable data transfer. This is one of the most important topics. That we've covered so far, because this is one that actually has some sort of serious possibilities for going wrong if you don't get it right. Now, when you're using TCP, of course, it's built into the TCP protocol, and you don't have to worry about it. But if you're ever trying to implement a protocol on your own, this is one of the tricky things in networking. And so we'll spend probably almost all of today on just the reliable data transfer, principles before we talk about how it gets reflected in TCP. Okay, so the abstract model is that the sending process sends some data over a reliable channel, and the receiver process gets it. Okay, that's simple enough. But the truth of the matter is that to implement the reliable channel, we're going to almost always have to rely on some unreliable channel. Just about every kind of actual physical channel you can think of has the potential for unreliability, and so it becomes up to the software in this transport layer to achieve reliability in the face of unreliable channels. Okay, so this part of the thing is actually reflected on the next slide, so we'll be able to see it better. Okay, so what happens? The red lines are the same place as they were on the previous slide, so that helps. The upper layer is going to make a call to reliable data transport send operation, which passes through the reliable transfer protocol code in the, say, operating system, and turns it into an unreliable send, okay, which gets us onto the channel. On the other side, I had to puzzle over this picture a little bit to understand it when I looked at it in the book, so let me give you a clue here. What happens here on the receiver is that a packet is received, and just as we were talking about last time with the demultiplexing, here in this lowest layer, you look at the packet and say, what is it? Well, it's a packet destined for this reliable data transfer protocol code. And so the demultiplexing process, when you receive this, actually makes this call into this RDT receive code part of this protocol. Okay, it seemed a little strange at first. Why isn't there a UDT receive here? Well, there sort of is, but it immediately gets turned into an RDT receive because that's what you got to do. You got to call the code in here that has to do with processing that packet. Okay, and then we deliver the data upwards. Questions about that? That's, you know, once you see it, I don't think it's too bad. Okay, so the plan of attack for reliable data transfer is to sort of incrementally develop approaches to this that handle more and more cases of things that may crop up. We are going to consider in this principles discussion only one-way data transfer. The data goes from the sender to the receiver. There's control messages coming back from the receiver to the sender that we'll talk about, but we just want to achieve one-way data transfer. TCP, of course, produces channels that work in both directions, But that's an optimization of these principles. Okay? The other thing that we're going to be seeing a lot of here is finite state machines. And just as a roadmap to that, the way that they've done this, and it's very common in describing, is to draw a horizontal line and above the line write what it was that happened that caused the transition, and below the line the actions that were taken locally in response or during that transition. Okay? So that's just a roadmap to the diagrams. Okay, so just as an illustration, suppose we have a reliable channel, what would the finite state machines look like? There's a sender finite state machine. It says, wait for that call from above, RDT send, right, is a call from above. And when you get one, then make a packet out of the data and send the packet using the UDT code. The receiver side, on the other hand, is waiting for this so-called up call from below. When a packet arrives, we make a call into this protocol. We call the RDT receive method, and we extract the data from the packet and deliver it upward. Okay, so that just illustrates how this is going to go. We're going to have finite state machines on both the sender and receiver, and they're going to do different things. Okay, so we said the reliable channel as a physical channel was unrealistic. So what can go wrong with a real channel? Well, one thing that can happen in a real channel is it can corrupt data. Okay, and we add, like we did in UDP, we add a checksum to the packets to detect those errors. But the question is, if we want to turn it into a reliable protocol, what do we have to do from then on? So the checksum lets us detect the errors. How do we recover from errors? One possibility is to have the receiver send acknowledgments to the sender that says, I got that okay. That means you can go onward. Or the other possibility is to have the receiver send so-called NACs, negative acknowledgments, saying, I didn't get that one. And in that case, the sender retransmits the packet when it gets a NAC. If the sender doesn't get an NAC after a while, it has to retransmit based on some sort of timeout. Okay, so Reliable Data Transport 2.0 has error detection and receiver feedback. Those are the new things that are introduced at this level. What does it look like? Okay. So, again, this is all triggered when we get a call from above that says send some data. All right? So when we get some data, make this a little clearer. The arrowheads are not very apparent on there. Okay, so we get a call to send some data, we make the packet, we send the packet, and then we go into a state where we're waiting for an acknowledgement. If we get a negative acknowledgement, we resend the packet. And if we get a positive acknowledgement, we go ahead and wait for the next call from above to send the next data. Okay, so that's pretty clear. On the receiver, what are we doing? We're always waiting for a call from below. If we get a corrupt packet, we send a NAC. And if we get a good packet, we send an ACK. Okay, so I was a little wrong in that previous slide. I said that we used ACKs or NACs. We're actually using both ACKs and NACs in this protocol. When we get an ACK, we go ahead and we're ready to send more data. When we get a NAC, we keep waiting. We resend and wait till we get an ACK. Yeah. What happens? Okay, so this protocol is just for for physical layers that only corrupt data. We'll get to lost packets here as we get to the next. Right, we're sort of slowly building our way up to that. Okay, but again, it gives you the idea of the style of these things. So you can trace through here what happens when you have no errors. You send an ACK, send it back, and go back. All right, so that's clear. Oh, this is a mess. If you get an error, you send an ACK, you send again, send back, and all right. So you can stay in this waiting for ACK or NACK state for a long time if there are a lot of errors. Went too far. Well, okay, so this is sort of illustrative of what goes on in designing these protocols. So we think we have a solution here. It seems to work fine, handles the corruption of the data packet okay, but you know, you have to think about what happens on the control messages too, right? If your channel can corrupt your data messages, it can also corrupt your control messages. And so that complicates the issue, because when the sender receives a corrupt ACK or NACK packet, it doesn't know which it is. Knows that the receiver got something, doesn't know whether it got it successfully or not successfully. And, you know, the natural thing to think of is we'll just send the next, and we'll just resend the packet. We'll assume it was a NACK. Well, that's not going to work because from the receiver's point of view, he already got the previous packet. If we send it to him again, he's going to think it's the next data. Right? So, to handle that, we add the next feature that always crops up in these things, is we add a sequence number, so now we can tell at the receiver whether we're getting a retransmission of the previous packet or the next packet. Okay? And if the receiver gets a duplicate, it throws it away. Okay? I think we have a diagram, so let's see. Yes. Let's see what it does. Okay, so notice we duplicated the set of states now. On the sender side, let's see. We do the same thing when we send. If we get a corrupt or NACK packet back, we resend what we sent. If we get an ACK back, we go on to waiting for the next call from above. There really should be a dashed arrow in here saying this is a call from above that gets us out of here, and we send a packet with sequence number 1. So let's underline that one and underline that one to show the difference. And then we get back here and it's sort of symmetric to that eventually. Okay, so we trigger back and forth between sending packets with sequence number 0 and sequence number 1. On the receive side, it's starting to get more complicated and harder to read. So here's the 0, and here's the 1 that we want to compare against. Those are the sequence numbers. Waiting for 0 from below, if we get it and it's good, we send an ACK and go on to waiting for one from below. If it's bad, we send an ACK. That is, if it's corrupt. If it's not corrupt, but it's the wrong one, we send an ACK. You're right, Chad. Right. Even if it's wrong, we send an acknowledgement. Okay? So you got to puzzle over these diagrams quite a bit to make sure that all the cases have been covered. Right. And to really understand what happens in all the cases. It's tricky because, I mean, you got to think about what's happening in the correct cases, and then in all the possible cases that can go wrong in the kind of channel that you've described for yourself. So in this case, we've only described a channel that can flip bits and cause corrupt packets, but still there are getting to be quite a few cases to deal with. We'll stop for questions. Okay, this just summarizes what we just said, went through. We doubled the number of states by having two sequence numbers. We're now able to determine whether the control messages were corrupted. This is important to note. The receiver actually never finds out whether its last ACK or NACK was received okay at the sender. When the sender goes on and sends the next message, the message with the next sequence number, then the receiver finds out that it was actually received okay. But otherwise, most of the time it doesn't necessarily know. Okay, so it's possible to get rid of the NACs by using timeouts. I keep wanting to introduce timeouts. We don't need timeouts yet. Essentially, we can replace, in this little protocol, the use of NAC by resending the last successful ACK. That's what is going on here. And when the sender gets the ACK for the wrong packet, he knows that that's like a NAC and does the appropriate thing. Okay? But the receiver is essentially including the sequence number as part of the acknowledgement. Okay, so that's just a tweak, not a biggie. So the state diagrams are in the book. You can look at them. The slides are nice in that they highlight the differences between RDT 2.1 and 2.2, but really all it's saying is that it's a ACK for the wrong packet is treated as if it were an ACK. Okay, so now we're to your channel that has errors and losses. Again, we have to remember that the things that are lost may be either the data packets or the control messages, the ACKs. So we'll have to deal with all of those. Now I get to have timeouts. Okay. All right. We need timeouts when there are losses because there's nothing to trigger the resending of the ACK or the resending of the packet. Okay. So, this channel is more complicated than you initially think, right? Because you say, okay, the channel can lose packets. Well, clearly, then we have to resend whatever it was that was to be resent. The problem is, the reason it's more complicated is because you can't tell the difference between, at any given time, a packet that's never going to show up and one that's just been delayed. Right? So, delayed packets and entirely missing packets looked just the same at any given point in time, and so you will potentially do whatever it is you do for a packet that is really missing. You will do whatever it is you do for a packet that is missing sometimes when the packet is just about to arrive. Right? And that means that you can generate duplicates. Okay. But if we use sequence numbers, we can handle that. We do have to include, the control message side is more interesting. We now must include the sequence number in the acknowledgments. Okay? And we need a timer because we have to wait a while, and if nothing happens, we have to try again. Good. So, oh boy, where do we start on this? what's new? That's the thing to start with. On the sender side, the new thing is the possibility of a timeout. This is what we didn't really have before. And the behavior of the sender when it gets a timeout is to resend the last packet. Okay? Simple enough. So you can think about what happens. Normal behavior is you send zero, you get it acknowledged, you send one, you get one acknowledged, you send zero. All right, so obvious. The error behavior is, the channel error behavior is you send packet 0, you get ACK 0, you send 1, nothing comes back, you wait a while, timeout, send it again, get an acknowledgement. Okay. Easy. Okay, that was in the case of a data packet loss. What happens if an ACK is lost? Same thing, right? Except it's more complicated. PID 1 here is sent, the ACK is sent, it's lost, we resend packet 1, the receiver has already got packet 1, so it knows it's a duplicate, it still acknowledges it, but it doesn't deliver it, and it just throws it away. Okay. I'm going to skip that slide for a second. So this protocol 3 is called a stop and wait protocol because the sender waits after sending every packet for an acknowledgement. And it doesn't go on until it gets an acknowledgement. So if you think about how long it takes for a packet, remember, a packet takes a finite non-zero amount of time to get to the other end, and so does the acknowledgement. We send for a while. This is one packet being sent here. It sort of propagates down, and the final bit is received at this point, and then the ACK can be sent. And so this is called the round trip time of the channel. And notice that it can be much, much longer than the time to just transmit the packet. Okay, so what fraction of the channel is the sender actually using? Well, the available amount of time in the channel is this much, but the sender only uses this much of it. Right? So a small fraction. So R is... Okay. So back to our fundamental equations. L over R is the amount of time that the sender is sending. L is, remember, the packet length, and R is the channel rate. Packet length, channel rate. Right. Gives the transmission time. That's the amount of time it's actually sending. The total amount of time from here to here is the round trip time plus L over R. So in the particular example laid out on the previous page, which we'll soon go back to, the actual channel utilization is like 0.027%. That's not 27%. That's not 2.7%. That's not 0.27%. It's 0.027%. All right? So using this protocol has horrible, horrible performance on channels where the round trip time is much longer than the transmission time. So the particular example here that he works through is a gigabit per second link, 15 milliseconds only of propagation delay, and a 1K byte packet. So the transmission time is only 8 microseconds. The round trip time is 30 milliseconds, and that's where this 0.0027 comes from. Okay, so the key thing to get here out of this is that the stop and wait protocols just have bad channel utilization when the round trip time is large relative to the channel bandwidth. Because they stop and wait, right? They send for a while, then they stop, and while they're stopped, nothing is happening. Questions about that? Okay. So, next thing to do is to fix that. What do you think we have to do to fix that? Right. We have to come up with some way that we can keep sending during this time. Pardon? Right. So that the fact that we're going to keep sending in here is going to severely complicate what we have to do with the AX. Right. That's the story. So those better protocols are called pipelined protocols, because essentially what it means is we have multiple packets all going at once over the channel, sort of like a pipeline, right? You're filling up the pipeline. Because we're going to have a lot more packets all out there at once, we're going to need a lot more sequence numbers. We'll figure out how many. And we're going to have a lot more buffering in the sender or the receiver, or both, to handle the cases when packets disappear. I mean, if I send a packet now, and then I send another dozen packets, And only after that does the first one even possibly get to the receiver. If it's missing, I have to have some way to go back and get it. So I can't throw them away as I go. So there are two generic kinds of pipeline protocols that we'll talk about. So-called go back N is one, and selective repeat is the other. And they have slightly different structures as to how they work. So we'll look at both of those. So this is a picture that follows on the previous similar picture. Suppose we could send three packets instead of one during each round trip time. Then we would triple the utilization. It would still be terrible, but we would have tripled it, and we would have a direction to go to send more. We'd have figured those out. Okay, so that's pipelined. All right. So two kinds. Go back in. The sender sends out a bunch of unacknowledged packets. The receiver, for go back in, sends what's called a cumulative ACK. That means it sends an ACK for the last packet received with none missing. Okay, that's what a cumulative ACK. So if the receiver has received 1, 2, 3, and 6, 7, 8, then which one does it acknowledge? 3, right? Because there's a gap before 6, 7, and 8. Okay, there's missing ones. So when it gets 6, it acknowledges 3, it gets 7, acknowledges 3, it gets 8, acknowledges 3. Okay? So it's really telling the sender, that's all the farther I've gotten, and tell me about the ones that are missing. Okay, so the sender keeps track of the oldest unacked packet, and if that timer expires, then it retransmits everything since that point. So that's why the go back in story. You go back to the point where things started to be missing and start over again. So, let's see. Do I have a... not a good picture. So the problem with go back in, of course, is that we could have received a lot of those packets that we're about to retransmit. So it's in some sense wasteful, right? In the example that I gave, right, we sent 1, 2, 3, 3 was acknowledged, and then we sent 6, 7, and 8, and they were all received, not acknowledged. So we had to go back to 4, and we resent 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8. Well, 6, 7, and 8 were already successfully received. Yeah. Okay, so that's selective repeat. Okay? We still let the sender have some maximum number of unacknowledged packets. The receiver acknowledges every packet with its own identity. And the sender keeps track of all the unacknowledged packets and resends them as necessary as timers go off. We did that. Repetitive. All right. So this is kind of small here. It says there's a k-bit sequence number in the packet header because we need more than one bit now, right? 0 and 1 is not enough. We need to be able to send up to n packets and have them be unacknowledged. So, from the sent, now this is from the sender's point of view. The green, this is history going along here, time going in this direction. At any given time, we will have got some packets that are all acknowledged. Sort of the entire history up to that point is acknowledged. Okay. Then we have some things that we've sent that are not acknowledged. That's the yellow packets here. And we have some ability to send some more packets without filling up our window size of n. Those are the blue ones. So the yellow ones have been sent. The blue ones have not yet been sent. Our application hasn't given us anything to send for those yet. Say. And beyond the window size, we're not allowed to send. Right? That's sort of the rule here, is that the sender may have up to N, he can't go beyond that point. He's required to stop if he gets there. So if all these blue ones had turned yellow, he'd have to stop. Well, he needs a timer for the oldest in-flight packet. Is sufficient. Having a timer for every in-flight packet is probably easier to manage from a code perspective, but strictly speaking, he only needs one for the oldest in-flight packet. When that one goes off, he resends that packet and everything after it. Okay? So go back in is pretty simple. And basically what we have to do is describe now in the finite state machines what happens to the base. Right? The base here is the oldest in-flight packet. It's important because it tells us what the first one we can't send is, among other things. And so our finite state machine has been updated with code, for example, here to say allowed to send. Right? Would it be okay to send this packet, or would I go beyond my window? And so on and so forth. On the receiver side, no, this is still the sender side. Other interesting things here, let me find the one. Interesting. Oh yeah, here. That's the one I'm looking for. This is the one that advances the window. When we get a successful acknowledgement. Right? When we get an acknowledgement for this oldest packet, then we get to move the window. We move the send base to the next packet. And that's the only time we're able to do that. Okay? So those are the kinds of things you have to dig out of these finite state machines. Yeah?
So for the window size, uh-huh. Usually like small enough.
You actually want the window size to be big enough that you're still sending at the point when you get back the ACK. When things are working well, right, you're still sending when you get back the ACK that says, I got this one. So then I never stop sending, and then I can use the channel continuously. Okay. So that raises the question, which we won't address right now, of how big should the window size be if I tell you what the round trip time is and the bandwidth. and packet size. Okay. We'll get to that. Okay. So the receiver, finite state machine, the key thing here is that it sends acts with sequence number of the last I want to say continuously received, but that's contiguously received. That's the right word. Contiguous received packet. Okay, so back to now this picture. We didn't have one of the receiver. Darn. Well, that's nasty. Well, okay, so let's go back here. On the receiver side, what's the story? We've got some number that we're all, here I'll be consistent, that we're all received. And then we may have some that are out here. And we'll have some that are missing. And so this is the one we keep acknowledging. Oh, yellow is a terrible color. When it's that thin. All right, go back in. So this is just a time evolution of what happens when a packet is lost. After losing packet 2, when we get packet 3, we acknowledge 1. That's the key thing here. And we keep acting 1 until the sender notices that he hasn't got an ACK for 2 and resends 2, then we ACK 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 as they get resent, and we're back in sync. Okay, good. Okay, so wasteful, as we described, selective repeat attempts to fix that by having the receiver acknowledge all of the correctly received packets that it gets. Notice this is important. Usually we want to have packets delivered in order up to the application. We don't want the application to be pestered with packets that are out of order. So the receiver in this case will have to hold on to them, to the ones that it has gotten without predecessors until it gets the predecessors and so that it can hand them up in the correct order. Sender now does have a timer for each unacked packet. Because it's going to treat each one separately. And the sender's window, again, is n sequence numbers all together. Yes. So same idea. It's not so much now that the sender is limited to having n packets in flight. It's actually limited to having n sequence numbers that are unacknowledged. So we'll see the consequences of that here. So the picture gets more complicated. Again, it's following the same color key on the sender side. He changed the color key. All right. So all of these are ACT. Okay. Then we have some that are sent but not ACT, and some that are already ACT. You can see that they're sort of mixed up all together. And again, the window size lets us go ahead from where we are, where we've already sent, if we want to. On the receiver side, the receiver has received all of these back in history, and it's now waiting for this one here at the receive base. Hasn't gotten that one yet. It's received some more, the red ones, that are out of order, right? Because they've arrived, but the gray one hasn't got here yet. So the red ones are out of order. And again, there are some numbers that it could accept potentially if they were sent. All right. It now gets to be really messy to describe these protocols with finite state machines that are drawn. And we're going to start using more textual descriptions to describe them. As before, when you get data that you're supposed to send, you look to see if it's allowed to send it by the window size. If not, you have to say back to the application, no, I can't send that yet, or hold on to it for later sending. If a particular packet times out, we resend it and restart its timer. And if we get an acknowledgement, we mark the packet as received. And if it happens to be that completes another contiguous bunch of packets, then we can advance our send base at that point. Okay. The receiver, when it receives a packet that is in the window, it acknowledges it. If it's out of order, it buffers it. If it's in order, it delivers it along with all the preceding packets that had not yet been delivered. If the packet is sort of in recent history, it just acknowledges it, says the acknowledgement was lost, and otherwise it ignores it. So packets that are sort of outside the window in either direction of the current receive base, it says, don't mean anything to me. So it just ignores it. Okay. So take a look in the book about this dilemma. The question here behind this dilemma is how many bits of sequence number space is needed. Okay? Turns out that you have to carefully distinguish between receiving packets and acknowledgments that are in the window and those that are outside of the window. And so in order to make sure that the outside of the window space is big enough to do that, you have to actually have twice as many sequence numbers available as you're ever going to have outstanding at once. Right? So you need essentially an extra bit to make that work. Take a look at that in the book. And maybe I'll start with that next time. It's not, I mean, we're going to move on to talking about the next topic next time, but I'll finish up with that. I'll do that next time. Okay, any quick questions? It's 11 o'clock, so. Okay, good. Wow. That's a real slog to get through all of that in one lecture. Pardon?
I think I might take a nap for the next class.